From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. It's always nice to have you. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We'll begin this week's episode with a question. Can prosecutors exclude potential jurors if those jurors are Black? A law passed in the 1980s called the Batson Rule says no, jurors cannot be dismissed based on their race. But in practice, it happens all the time.
We discussed the Batson Rule on the program as it relates to a number of cases, especially a recent one that made its way to the Supreme Court. This clip begins with audio from a video produced in the 1980s, just months after that Supreme Court decision on the Batson Rule. This was made in Philadelphia, where prosecutors are training their colleagues how to get around the Batson Rule. It can be hard to listen to. They're essentially telling the prosecutors in the room, you want to exclude Black people from the jury, but you have to come up with reasons other than race. Here's how you do it. So you'll hear that clip, then you'll hear reaction from our guests, local attorneys Don Thompson, Bill Easton, Mark Foti, and Aaron Frazier.
Let's face it again. There's the Blacks from the low-income areas are less likely to convict. I understand it. It's understandable proposition. There's a resentment for law enforcement. There's a resentment for authority. And as a result, you don't want those people on your jury. In my experience, Black women, young Black women, are very bad. There's an antagonism, I guess maybe because they're downtrodden on two respects. They got two minorities, they're women and they're Blacks. And so they're downtrodden on two areas and they somehow want to take it out on somebody and you don't want it to be you. Younger Black women are difficult.
So what does Jack McMahon, the prosecutor, advise his colleagues to do about that? Here's this explicit advice on how to get around the Batson Rule.
In the future, we're going to have to be aware of this case, and the best way to avoid any problems with it is to protect yourself. And my advice would be in that situation is when you do have a Black juror, you question them at length, and on this little sheet that you have, mark something down that you can articulate later time if something happens. Because the way the case is stated, that it's only after a prima facie showing that you're doing this that it becomes that the trial judge can then order you to then start showing why you're striking them not on racial basis. So let's say you strike three Blacks to start with, the first three people, and then it's like the defense attorney makes an objection saying that you're striking Blacks. Well, you're not going to be able to go back and say, make something up about why he did it. Write it down right then and there. I'd write it right in my little box there, you know, and question him and say, well, the woman had a kid about the same age as the defendant, and I thought she'd be sympathetic to him, or she's unemployed, and I just don't like unemployed people because I find they're not too stable. Any of those reasons, have them marked down in those situations so that if the judge does come to you and say, what about it, McMahon? You could say, judge, this is my reasons, and I have them marked down here. If he puts you into that situation.
Does anybody want to defend this? I mean, look, I'm not in the legal system. I find that vulgar. Is there a defense for this?
No.
Right now.
He's teaching prosecutors how to lie effectively to the court. There's no defense for that.
Right.
Okay. Does anybody want to tell me, Evan, be careful because that's more of an outlier, that this kind of advice is not spread widely in prosecutorial quarters? Bill, get right on your mic, Bill.
I would argue no. It might be an outlier in the degree of candor the man had.
It's a lot of candor.
Yeah, but I think that type of dialogue is either internalized in offices or in individual prosecutors. I mean, Batson is, you know, puts them to the test to come up with a race-neutral reason. And they're lawyers. And lawyers are pretty inventive. And if you can't come up with at least a superficial race-neutral reason, then you're just not trying. I mean, you can always come up with something, especially if you've been trained to question the African-American jurors at length and ignore the white jurors. And then you're going to have fodder from which to construct very easily what will be a transparently superficial race-neutral reason.
I mean, it's a whole other show on the fact that this guy thinks that unemployed people are unstable. So just point to that. But my goodness, that's just hard for me to listen to.
You know, on the issue of this effort to overcome Batson, in the Flowers case, this case itself was not an outlier in that office. And there was evidence of that was established in the podcast that gave this some media attention in the Dark Season 2. They did a whole episode of that podcast directed on the issue of jury selection on Batson violations. And they went back and did research on all of the jury selection that was undertaken by this office. And they ultimately determined that throughout all trials that—
Not just the Flowers trial?
Not just the Flowers
trial. Because Justice Alito, in his joining opinion, seemed to think this was an outlier. The Flowers case was cartoonish. But thank goodness this doesn't happen more often.
Right. I mean, in their research of just of this office, completely separate from the Flowers trial, I believe that the numbers were prospective black jurors were struck at it was three times or higher than prospective white jurors. So there's this huge disparity there, clearly being demonstrated from case to case to case. And there are district attorney's offices where this is common practice. And I agree with Bill that for some, maybe it's not an office-wide policy that's overtly trained, but it's more of the internalizing that goes on for an individual prosecutor who does not want a juror to be seated, and so they are going to have an argument for legal purposes, but also for their own integrity. None of them are going to come out and say, yes, Judge, you know, I didn't because of his race or gender. They're going to have some explanation to protect themselves as well. So it's— these strategies are going to be developed one way or another. If whether that's the intent or not, there's going to be some explanation provided that allows prosecutors to consistently overcome Batson in the courtroom.
Aaron Frazier, what do you make of it when you heard Jack McMahon there on tape?
Again, I don't think it's uncommon. I think it was recorded, and that's why we know about it. I think those meetings and trainings happen quite often around the country. It's just probably not recorded in a way that, you know, the public can see how the sausage is made, so to speak. But it is a problem with prosecutorial offices. And I Mark made a good point, because Batson actually does apply to defense as well. But you don't see this problem as often on the defense side. You know, defense attorneys can't discriminate against jurors on the basis of race either. And, you know, some prosecutors or some people who want to defend the system might try to make this equality argument where, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Both sides can do it. Both sides have it. But that's not true. That's not a fair argument, because statistically it does not happen on the defense side as much as it happens on the prosecutor side, even though both of them have peremptory challenges and both of them have this parameter that they have to that they have to stick to. So it's, you know, it doesn't surprise me. The only thing that was surprising was that he spoke so candidly on camera or audio or whatever the recording device was.
He's on camera too.
Yeah.
He wants as many people to see this as possible in his profession.
Yeah.
It's legal. None of what he said is illegal.
Right.
Next, the story of a local woman who ran every street in Rochester. Abby McCarthy spent 6 months running 2,000 streets in the city of Rochester, roughly 900 miles, and she's heard a range of opinions about her journey.
She shared her take with us on Connections. Evan asked her if she found anything unexpected as she ran all of those streets. Here's what she said.
Some neighborhoods I know, like North Winton neighborhood, I've been there enough times. The 19th Ward across the river, I've been there enough times that I kind of know and expect, but there were always these little treasures. Even running in Swoburg, I'd find these little tiny parks that I had no idea were skulking in these corners. And so I didn't really know what to expect, and I didn't expect anything, honestly. Sometimes to my own detriment, I didn't expect there to be a lot of hills on the north end of Lake.
Mm-hmm.
There are. You should not plan to do a speed workout when you're running up and down hills as well. This was problematic. Some kids were outside playing basketball at one point when I was trying to charge up and down their hill, and they started running with me, handedly beating me on each hill repeat, but it was good company anyway. But yeah, I didn't go with like a heavy heart, oh, I'm going to this area today and I don't know what I'm going to find. And I just was like, okay, I'm going to run up here. And I would look on Google Streets to see like, oh, is there a good place for me to park? Where is there a shoulder where I can park, or a place to lock up my bike or whatever it was? Look on Google Streets and then just go from there. Because and anybody who's driven through Rochester, you know, in like a 5 mile distance, you can see a lot of different things. You can be in a lot of different places. So,
well, it wasn't that long ago that, in fact, I'm trying to pull it up here, that one of our listeners, I'm not sure he's a regular listener, he might listen to the more commercial stations if you catch my drift, but he was challenging the idea that you could walk safely in certain parts of the city. And, you know, he's talking to me about Northeast Rochester and challenged me. And I said, anytime you want to walk, let's go.
Yeah,
you and
I would
me.
Go.
So let's talk about that, because I've heard every time we talk about Rochester neighborhoods and making the city stronger, I hear from some listeners who tell me, Evan, don't ignore the fact that there are still parts of Rochester where you just can't go. And my response to that is, I live in Rochester. I spend a lot more time than most Rochesterians in all parts of Rochester. And I don't agree with that. I'm not saying that it's perfect everywhere, but you know where what there is in every street and every neighborhood of Rochester? People who want to go to work, people who want to raise their kids, people who want to be safe. That's everywhere. You find that everywhere. And I dispute the notion that you just can't go places. Well, you've gone to every place. Did you ever feel unsafe?
No.
Not one time?
No.
902 miles, never once?
No. There weren't any creeks full of snakes, so that would have been the most scary thing I could have come across. So, no, I didn't. Not a single time. There was one point where I didn't know where I was and I got turned around, but that wasn't scary because, you know, you can always find like a vein like Lake or Goodman or Culver, and then you kind of get a sense of where you were, but no one was intimidating. I wasn't scared at any point.
Were you ever hollered at, yelled at, catcalled?
Yeah, you know, there was one day where I was running, it was like Upper Falls area, and a gentleman said to me, you're a long way from Irondequoit, which, I mean, honestly, it was really only like 3 miles, so I didn't really have a great concept of how small the city is anyway. And it was definitely it came off as to me as, this is not where you belong. And the way that felt to me then flashed back on me and realized I've only felt that way in that moment. And so many people have experienced for so much of their lives those looks that you don't belong here. And so if I had to feel that for 5 seconds, you know, 2 minutes, half an hour, it was pale in comparison to every time someone walks into a neighborhood that isn't their own and they feel like people are like, you don't belong here. What are you doing here? And watching them more closely. You know, I think that it gave me a little taste of that. And it really is, it's bad medicine. And I think it only further divides those lines. So if you never walk in the streets, you'll never look like you're supposed to be there. And if, you know, we don't feel welcome in any place, no one's going to feel welcome in ours. So I kind of want to see more mingling. Just leave your network and go into another one. And no one ever threatened me in any way. I'm not a fast runner. So if anybody wanted any chance to say anything wicked, they could have. Actually, one day I was running on Webster, which is off of Bay and Goodman area. And it was like maybe like a 12-mile day. So I had started my day and I saw this one gentleman and he's like, morning and morning, just sort of shouting greetings and hellos. And he came back from whatever errand he was doing and there's a bunch of dead end streets. And so every time there's a dead end, you have to run into it and then you have to run back out of it. And he was just walking up on Webster. So we were able to kind of continue on this conversation about what I was doing. Was I going to go to the army now? Was I doing their free basic training for them essentially? And we just were chatting as I went up and down these streets. And as I popped back out on Webster, I'd kind of run next to him and we'd chat and go back up on the street. And my friend mentioned, he's like, what was this mile? You ran this really fast. And I was like, oh, I found a friend and I was talking to him. And, you know, I never would have gotten a chance to meet this gentleman otherwise. And it was just such a nice exposure and conversation. And yeah, I was happy for it.
We'll end the week with what we think is one of the most uplifting and compelling conversations we've had on the show in recent months. Crystal Ellis is the Director of Communications and Special Events at the Ronald McDonald House Charities of Rochester. She was one of 12 women featured in a special edition of Lake Effect magazine, which is celebrating 25 years of publication.
The women highlighted in that 55th volume were selected for their contributions to the community and their powerful stories and spirits. Crystal's story
and her advice brought some of our guests and listeners to tears. It was a moving conversation, and you'll hear part of it now. This is Crystal discussing an event in her life that inspired her.
The birth of my baby powerhouse, Brooke Ellis. Well, I'm an ovarian cancer survivor. 24, I was told I could never have children. And then I went on about my life, got married, and frolicked into the sunshine. And then we found out that we were having a baby. Unfortunately, at our first ultrasound, we found out that she was highly deformed. We had a lot of medical issues. So we didn't really tell much people that we were having a baby because we were told she would either die before we give birth or she'll die the day of. So she made an early appearance. She was in the hospital for 6 months before we could take her home. She's had so many surgeries, can't even count. Actually, 18 surgeries, 19 on August 21st, and 4 resuscitations so far. But let me tell you something. It is nothing to cry about and everything to celebrate because she has made me strong, my family strong. And, you know, a lot of times families with special needs kids, they don't make it. And then sometimes we're just underneath a blanket and it's quiet. No one really talks about us often. But I'm here to say that we are thriving and we are surviving and we're grateful for this. And she still has some issues. We have nursing services for her. So go and fight for nursing services. Really important. But you know what? It's a good thing. It's a good thing. I wake up every day and I'm like, yes, another day to do good things.
How old is she now?
She's 6 years old.
6 years old.
Yeah.
You mentioned that, you know, giving up, waving the white flag is not in her DNA.
It's not.
It's interesting. Even at a young age, you can see persistence and determination.
Absolutely.
Even in a baby.
Yeah, and she's totally funny. I mean, she was born with the middle section of her brain missing, so she has a few delays. But recently this week, she loves fruit snacks. So I had some scissors in my hand, and she's like, Mommy, can you help me? Because she's trying to bite it open. And I had the scissors in my hand, and I took it from her, and I started to try to bite it open, and I was totally struggling. She goes, Mom, you know you can use the scissors, right? And every day she reminds me of, you know, to just keep pushing and never to count someone out. And we have that tendency of doing that, even counting ourselves out. And then we cry, and I look at her, and I'm like, why am I counting myself out? I could do so much more because she doesn't know that she has a disability. She just knows that she has a bunch of abilities. So she inspires me and the people around her all the time.
Oh boy, I think I just want to ask you, tell me a little bit about where this mindset comes from, because I would never begrudge anyone in your family situation, any parents, for having a lot of rainy days and feeling a lot of gloom and sadness or a why me. Which, you know, is probably natural for a lot of people. And you have this powerhouse, positive ray of sunshine, despite anything that has come in your path. How and why?
Oh, gosh. It's called the transformation of the mind. You have the choice to be sad, to be defeated, or you say, what am I going to let into my mind? Because whatever goes into my ears, goes into my mouth, goes into my heart, comes out of my mouth. And whatever I speak becomes real. So I have the revelation that what I say is what I will have. So if I have joy, it's going to be joy. If I say I'm going to be angry, I'm going to be angry. And you watch it manifest. And it's something that all the women in my life has taught me. And they said one thing about it, no time for tears. You kick the door down and you stand firm when you're in it. Don't be moved. Be like a palm tree, not like an oak. Bend when the wind comes around. It could be 120 mile per hour wind. You stand there and you stand firm in it. And you bring others along with you and you just love. And when you're bending, be shadow for others who are tired from the sun.
Let's talk a little bit about advice to young women. Oh, look, we're getting Michelle Cardillo. We're getting her.
You're getting me.
Well, let's talk a little bit about advice to young women. You say in the magazine, authenticity is greater than approval.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
A lot of time we're looking for the yes, you know, you did well, or the head nod. We should be able to do things without having to look left or right for approval. We're all born with a purpose, and we have a responsibility to fulfill it. whether we get the approval or not. So why in the world would you be born an original to die a copy? There's a graveyard, there's Mount Hope Cemetery, and it's filled with undone dreams, undone purpose. So why look at it and die there, and your ideas die there? You have everything from the time you were born down on the inside of you to fulfill everything on earth that you set your mind to. So TikTok, because it's time to do it, and it's time to do it now.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you Monday.
Bye.